Well, we continue with this wonderful series that's been led by all these wonderful teachers from the Vanderbilt History Department. This series on perspectives on America, both past and present. And I have failed from the very beginning of this series to acknowledge who put this series together. And we've had wonderful professors, and another one today. But Sam McSaveny is the one that was the brainstorm and did all the legwork in getting all these wonderful professors. Well, I should say, I don't know if I said that the first day or not. But anyway, and today we have Dr. Swartz. He said, told me this morning to call him Tom. But anyway, the degrees, I just can't call a person with all the degrees he has just Tom. But Thomas Allen Swartz. He's the associate chair of the Department of History at Vanderbilt. Came here and joined the department in 1990. He was educated at Columbia. Now that's not Columbia State Community College, where from my hometown. That's the Columbia. He got his BA there, and then his MA at Oxford, and then he got a double MA. He got another MA, master's at Harvard, and his PhD at Harvard. He's the author of many books. Some of them are America's Germany, John J. McCloy and the Federal Republic of Germany in 1991. And another book, Lyndon Johnson in Europe, in the shadow of Vietnam. As well as the edited volume, The Strained Alliance, United States-European Relations in the 1970s, which will be published, incidentally, by Cambridge University Press in this year, 2009. He's received fellowships from various places around the country, from the German Historical Institute, the Norwegian Nobel Institute, the Woodrow Wilson Center, and the Social Science Research Center. He serves on the Historical Advisory Committee of the Department of State, and he is president of the Society of Historians of American Foreign Relations. He's currently working on a biography of the former Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, entitled Henry Kissinger and the Dilemmas of American Power. He also, I understand, has a strong research interest in the history of the Cold War. It's a great deal of pleasure. We welcome Dr. Swartz, and today, of course, he's going to be a very timely subject of President Obama's world, historical perspectives on contemporary American and foreign policy. Thank you for being here.
All right. I guess I've got to hook this up, Anne-Marie, somewhere.
Let me put that on here.
Okay. I want to thank the center here for inviting me. What they realized rather soon was that it's almost impossible for anyone in the history department to say no to Sam McSaveny. Sam was the chair when I got here. I owe him much more than I could ever express in terms of my own career. I hope I didn't turn it off here.
No.
Is it on? Okay. Too many cartridges on your belt these days between cell phones and all the rest. I also see in the audience a couple of my other mentors here, Irwin Hargrove and Paul Konkin. That makes me a little intimidated, so I guess I have to say that off the top of my head. I had hoped, Sam had mentioned that sometimes people I can invite questions during it. That may be a little more complicated with the reasons, but I don't want to tell you to hold your questions. If I confuse you, please raise your hand. I'm going to try to cover a wider range of topics, but I will leave time at the end for plenty of questions hope that we can really engage in some discussions. I've been tearing up and rewriting this lecture for the last couple of weeks because foreign policy of Barack Obama's administration is in a process of being developed. I got a call today I occasionally do these sorts of commentaries for, this was a call from Reuters news agency, asking me whether I thought pirates would be a big test of the administration. And I have to admit that I never would have thought I'd ever be asked about pirates. But these sorts of things are out there, and foreign policy can surprise you. I love telling my students that there were three things I never expected to see in my lifetime. One was an economic crash paralleling the Great Depression. I thought we had surpassed that. The second was an African-American president. I didn't think we would ever get there. And the third was Vanderbilt winning a bowl game. I think those three things made me realize that there is the capacity for surprise and change is all over. I'm going to try the value added that I can give beyond any of you who are good readers of the New York Times or of all contemporary newspapers and magazines on contemporary foreign policy. The value added I can give to any of your perspectives is to dip a bit into history and to try to give some historical perspective on the world that Barack Obama inherited. So I will try to talk from history. I occasionally will slip into a bit of contemporary speak, but I'll try to talk a little bit and bring us back to historical perspectives. Let's see if this works. Let's see. There we go. Comparisons are in vogue. Barack Obama particularly likes the comparison with Abraham Lincoln. It's one he's fostered. We're going to have a Class Day speaker chosen who wrote a book called Team of Rivals that accentuated that President Obama claimed to have wanted to model himself after. Obviously, the other two presidents up there, John Kennedy and Franklin Roosevelt, have also served as frequently convenient comparisons. In fact, this European trip brought back to many the memories of John Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy going to Europe in 1961. Time magazine did an interesting Photoshop making Barack Obama into Franklin Roosevelt. I don't think Barack Obama ever used a cigarette holder. That was one comparison that I thought was rather strange. But it was the idea, of course, that he's inherited an economic crisis makes the comparison to Roosevelt, of course, come through. Those are, you might say, comparisons that all tend to be rather flattering to the president. Let me offer another possibility, and I'm doing this a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but let me offer it, and I'll quote, and I'm going to quote myself for a second on a review essay I recently started, you'll see why. A president is elected promising to bring Americans together after a tumultuous and historic political campaign. At his inaugural, he proclaims a new era of negotiations with America's enemies. He recognizes that he has inherited a country deeply divided by an ongoing and seemingly stalemated war. This war had also led to a sharp increase in anti-Americanism throughout the world, especially among allies, who felt that America acted alone and without consultation. Adding to his problems is a sharp economic downturn after a long period of economic growth, a recession that's led many Americans to become more isolationist and protectionist. To many commentators, it seems that the United States is now entering a period of decline in its power and influence in the world. Sound familiar? No, this is not Barack Obama today, but surprise, Richard Nixon. Now, before I get expelled from the Academy for even suggesting such a comparison, let me simply say, in many respects, Nixon, like Obama, inherited a polarized country and promised to heal those divisions. In fact, as a teenager, remember him on inaugural night talking about how he had seen a girl who had held up a sign, "Bring us together," and that would be his theme. Nixon believed also he could be a peacemaking leader by talking to America's foes and working with America's allies. But as I say, before I get expelled from the Academy, let me underline that I'm not suggesting personal comparisons between the two men. Anyone who's spent as much time as I have with the Nixon tapes knows that would be a frightening thought. Nevertheless, having said that, I think there are disturbing similarities between the worlds both have inherited and both want to change. And that's going to be one of my themes as I talk to you today. So I brew that as a provocative point. Nixon did have a foreign policy, Obama less so. although his background and his life have certainly given him, I think, certain ideas about foreign policy and concepts. Now, the first point I want to make is that Obama has also probably, like Woodrow Wilson, inherited a moment in time. And I call it the Obama moment because it is a bit like the Wilsonian moment. That moment in 1918 when Wilson strode across the world as the victor in World War I, the key figure, a man who seemed to promise self-determination for oppressed peoples around the world, who elicited calls from all corners of the globe for people who felt he understood and would defend their interests. And the Obama moment was an extraordinary one. I happened to spend Election Day in, of all places, Vietnam, which was probably one of the few countries in the world which also had a McCain constituency. There were quite a number of Vietnamese who knew of McCain's involvement with their country and favored him. But as we walked through the marketplace in a city outside of Hue on Election Day, I could overhear peasants and I could overhear the word Obama. And Obama, the fascination with Obama was extraordinary. It's hard to capture that. Emails from a former student living in Indonesia to all of her friends saying how important it would be for Indonesia that Obama was elected. Emails from my European colleagues sort of encouraging and then just overjoyed with his election. There was something of the Obama moment, and one could see this past week that it there's an element that's still there very much in the reception that he received in England, France, the Czech Republic, and most extraordinary, I think, in Turkey. It's worth noting, of course, that there were still demonstrations. The Obama moment does not change that fact, but it does seem to have a power around the world, a fascination, and this may give President Obama opportunities in foreign policy that need to be at least underlined and considered. The second point I'd like to make, though, about President Obama's world is that it is intriguing to recognize that he would not be president were he not the candidate of the anti-war left in the United States. That, in fact, his great advantage and the reason he is in the Oval Office instead of Hillary Clinton came from the very stout resistance and argument he made about the Iraq War, no ifs, ands, or buts about his view of the war as a mistake, and in effect making Senator Clinton very uncomfortable in the fact that she had voted for presidential authorization. Historically, anti-war sentiments have been a powerful element of the Democratic Party. And I raise this point only to remind us, even though it may be very quiescent now, that President Obama may face at some point the issue of his own party's very powerful anti-war constituents. Our anti-war sentiments go back historically. Almost every war in the United States' history has had strong elements of opposition to it. We can go back into the 19th century, as some of my colleagues know better than I do, of the War of 1812 or the Mexican War or other wars that have produced opposition. The Iraq War produced a powerful anti-war movement, not of the kind of the Vietnam War, but still significant enough, and particularly politically significant enough in the 2006 elections, and then in its support for Barack Obama and mobilizing his base. And I bring that up because I think it will be one of the challenges he will face as he tries to bring about and carry on what I call Obama's new realism. Now, I'm not going to get into a long discussion of realism. Professor Hargrove's going to be much more helpful on that next week in discussing this issue. What I'm going to talk about, you might say, is the what seems to be the making of Obama's foreign policy philosophy, of a new realism in American foreign policy. And here I use realism in a very almost a simple sense of a move away from the proclamation of either a crusade for democracy, as George Bush talked about, or discussions of human rights, as Jimmy Carter once did, a move toward a foreign policy based on American interests, and interests fairly narrowly defined in terms of America's objectives in the world. Now, some of this realism comes from the interconnected sense of America's problems right now. The first is, of course, comes from the perception of economic constraints existing because of the crisis that has sort of sent the whole Western world into a deep recession. Domestic priorities are clearly President Obama's chief objective here. His goal for transforming, you might say, and completing the New Deal or Great Society with changes in healthcare, energy, and the environment. Also has entailed, as Secretary Gates discussed the other day, a set of defense budget cuts, so that this is part of the issue. This was actually also paralleling when the Nixon administration came in. One of the things it faced almost immediately was the fact that the Pentagon budget was seen as a barrier. Nixon, unlike Obama, did not have a Congress of his party and did face a repeated set of challenges over defense spending. And it did constrain, I think, the ideas and objectives of the foreign policy. So I think economic constraints themselves as a background factor for Obama's foreign policy. The second point, multilateralism. Multilateralism is, of course, what Barack Obama has talked about a great deal. The idea that the United States needs to listen more, act with other countries, act through international institutions like the United Nations. Multilateralism is obviously the preferred tool of the Obama administration. But multilateralism can also be linked very much to a realist idea of foreign policy. Namely, multilateralism can provide an excuse for inaction. Multilateralism can be, as it has been, for example, in the Sudan, where the international community has acknowledged a horrendous humanitarian crisis, but because no country is willing to step forward to really lead in the process, and especially the United States, one sees inaction. What I'm getting here is a little bit like what President Obama did with the North Korean missile test, arguing that the United Nations needs to handle it. Well, that may be, but it's also likely that given the structure of the United Nations, nothing will happen. Now, that may be, of course, that the administration sees that nothing should be done. But multilateralism in this sense can be an argument for a much more restrained and conservative foreign policy. And it is, of course, also Barack Obama's argument that the United States needs again to regain the respect and cooperation of the world. The third point, and here I'll elaborate on this, and it's similar to the others, but the notion of a limit on U.S. power and the need for priorities in that the limits of U.S. power forces the United States to prioritize its objectives. And what I mean by this is that the United States has to recognize, and I think this is clear in President Obama and his advisors, that there will be certain things it really wants to accomplish, and because of that, other things will have to take a second place. Most clearly, for example, one could see this, and I'll get to this in more detail in the case of Russia, where the need for Russian cooperation, especially in the case of Iran, far outweighs concerns about Russian behavior in its near region and its behavior toward its former toward former parts of the Soviet Union. This probably means a much less of an emphasis on human rights and on certain types of behavior of regimes with which we need cooperation. This was probably most clearly caught in Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's comment to the Chinese officials that, well, we have talked about human rights, but we don't want to emphasize that again. Let's talk about what really matters, which is, of course, our economic relationship. So I think what you're seeing here is a prioritization of a set of combined interests, a prioritization that will have consequences. I think on the whole, it will probably gain a great deal of support, but it will also face challenges as he goes along. And the final point is, of course, this notion of negotiations with adversaries. Another aspect of the Obama campaign, I think you got a cap. another aspect of the Obama campaign was the idea of talking to adversaries around the world. Now, this became